Boston and NPR. I'm John Donvan, and this is The Connection. In 1791, political philosopher Jeremy Bentham designed the Panopticon. It was a kind of circular prison that allowed for constant supervision of the prisoners. The theory was, if the prisoners were watched at all times, they would behave at all times. Is that also the theory behind the omnipresence of surveillance cameras in our lives today? We have them in banks, at ATMs, in subway stations, and anywhere we perceive a potential safety threat. We're getting used to them, even if we are a little put off by lenses watching us at intersections, along highways, and even in restrooms. At this year's Super Bowl, a biometric surveillance system actually scanned the faces of entering spectators and compared their images to a database of criminals. Just last week, Tampa police installed a similar technology in one of its neighborhoods. The line seems to be moving. The camera is seeing more and more. Privacy advocates are enraged. Connection listeners, where do we draw the line between public safety and personal privacy? And can policy ever catch up to technology? Which camera goes over the line for you? 1-800-425-TALK is the number to make the video surveillance connection. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or join us online at www.theconnection.org. And I'm joined online now by Dr. Joseph Adick. He is the president and CEO of Visionics, and that is the company that makes the technology called FaceIt, FaceIt software, which is being installed in Tampa, as we just mentioned. Dr. Adick, you have come up with a technology that is truly marvelous and amazing, and at the same time comes with its very own built-in public relations problem, as I'm sure you're aware. Tell me what exactly this does and why police departments are so interested in it.
Well, the reason police departments are interested in it is because it allows them to do what they've been doing all along much more efficiently, being able to look out for criminals which are in their database of mugshots automatically and much more accurately than they've been able to do in the past. So the technology looks out in the field of view of a camera and matches the faces that it sees against the criminals in the database. If a match happens, it alerts the police, and the police does the final determination.
So just to picture this briefly, the camera scans a crowd and zooms in on one face?
It scans the crowds. It doesn't have to zoom in on any given face. It just captures all the faces that it sees in front of the camera, and it matches the faces against the database of known criminals. If a match happens, then it keeps that face which had the match. If a match doesn't happen, then it has no memory of who was in front of it.
How accurate would you say the technology is now?
It very much depends on the image quality that is available and whether you're able to get enough information about the face. But you have to keep in mind is that the technology is not doing the determination itself. It's an advisory tool. It advises the police, which then does the manual process like they did in the past, looking at the mugshot image against the actual live image.
I want to bring in Bob Lack, who we're speaking with from the UK. He is the group leader in the community of Newham and head of the Newham Emergency and Security Services. I'll point out that Newham is a customer of Dr. Adick's. And Mr. Lack, how long have you had the FaceIt technology in effect in Newham?
No, I've been using the technology since October of 1998, so some considerable time.
And you had already, Newham was already fairly wired for surveillance, as I understand it.
We've used cameras extensively. I mean, there's 300 cameras in the borough, but they're aimed to look after people, and they're aimed to particularly target our criminal, living, resident criminal element, and they work very well.
And where do you actually post the cameras?
Cameras are all clearly marked. They're posted in the high streets by the entrance to our tube stations, your subways.
I just want to translate for our American audience. A high street is a main street. So basically we're talking downtown where there are a lot of people and businesses.
Main street where the businesses, the people, and the shops are. Where people and people volunteer access to criminals, to their handbags, their wallets, their money.
In a say, a four-block area, in an area where you have the cameras posted, how many cameras would you have in an area like that?
Around each shopping centre, we've probably got about 50 cameras, total of 300 all told in the borough.
And how effective has the FaceIt technology been?
The FaceIt technology is very effective. The FaceIt technology does a permanent, non-blinking job that a human being would do and only returns to the human being when there's a likelihood of a match. So what we're doing is saving an incredible amount of man hours and stressful viewing to look for these criminals that are out there.
Okay, you see somebody who you a match is made. What do? Do you go out and talk to the guy?
That will depend on the chap himself. But effectively, if we see a match, we'll talk to our local police. They will make a decision as to what they want done. But one thing that has been an enormous spin-off from this is that our shopping areas, the main roads, are becoming much, much safer and have lower crime rates than anywhere else in the vicinity.
Now, there's a little bit of a cultural disconnect. As an American who has lived in the UK, I know that due to fear of terrorism, IRA, et cetera, that the British public is a little bit more tolerant about being looked at, having handbags searched, having to make accommodations. I think a lot of Americans would find it a very uncomfortable thing to walk into a neighborhood and see the camera moving when all they want to do is shop. Now, I've just said that there's some support in the public there. Are there any people over there who are not comfortable with the system?
Well, number one, you shouldn't be frightened of it. It's there to help and it's there to look after you, and that's the important factor. Yes, there are small minority groups that are against what we're doing, but if we look at Newham alone, the Visionic software has helped Newham gain a 93% yes vote from its population as to the use of the system and the use of CCTV in general, because they feel safer.
How many arrests has the software actually helped you make?
That's the joy of the system. We've actually made no arrests from the system because crime has gone down group don't actually misbehave when they come into our shopping areas.
I want you to make that case better to me, because when I hear you say that the system is working extremely well and yet you've made no arrests, you're hailing that as a success. Take me through the logic of that again, because I would think you would want to say, well, we caught this guy, we caught that guy, and the streets are safer because they're off the streets.
If CCTV, which is more than a camera on a pole, if CCTV is being effective, the crime rate should drop. You shouldn't be making lots of arrests out of it. And here, with this Visionic software, the most important thing to us is that we've actually turned the tide on the criminal. Their perception of detection has increased. They are more feared of being caught in these areas, therefore they commit no crimes. They come into the area, they use the area, they carry on like the rest of us would. Let everybody else go about their normal working life without fear of crime.
Is there any possibility they're moving to other neighborhoods where the cameras aren't to do their dirty work?
We have other areas in London where the crime rate is higher than us. I've got to admit I'm more interested in what happens in Newham. And in Newham, we're reaching a point of saying that 5 years ago we would have been among the top four worst performers for crime. Now we're amongst the lower end of the top 10. So that pleases us. Other boroughs are catching up and are doing what we're doing. We've got to turn the tide on the criminal. It's not about the honest person. It's about the criminal.
Dr. Addick, you see where this question is going in terms of Americans and putting these into American communities where, number one, there is an instantaneous touch-the-stove type of reaction from Americans when they hear about cameras, any kind of privacy violation. They get nervous, uncomfortable. Can you sell this to Americans?
Yeah, I mean, I very much understand the concerns of privacy groups in the United States, actually. And I believe if they look at the way the implementation has been done, say, in Tampa, they would understand that those concerns have been addressed. And if you allow me, those concerns are actually stem from the fact of fear of mass surveillance and stem from the fear of some covert operation being done by the government to kind of track us and link our behavior. And if you look at what's happening in Tampa, the responsible use guidelines say that this is not a covert operation. Public knowledge through proper signage, through informing the media and the local community. Also, the database that is used to identify people is populated with known criminals and actually fugitives with warrants for their arrest. So it's not really identifying people, it's identifying criminals. And third, if there is no match, there's no memory. There's no audit trail is recorded. Unlike digital recording equipment, which is gaining popularity now, there is no audit trail of somebody eating a sandwich or staying downtown or walking or lingering. None of that is happening. This pinpoints the presence of known fugitives and alerts the police, and it's not changing the dynamics of what the police has to do at that point in time.
I want to bring in them. Thank you. I'd like to bring in David Sobel, who is general counsel for EPIC. That's the Electronic Privacy Information Center based in D.C. And Mr. Sobel, the point Dr. Addick was just making in part was if the public is warned, advised with signs, you are being watched, then there's really no loss in privacy. There's no hardship there. What's your response to that?
Well, I would disagree with that. I think that when you talk about notifying the public after the fact, you're dropping out of the debate the whole question of whether there should be a debate. I think the problem here, a large part of the problem, is that we have not in this country yet had a public debate to weigh the pros and cons. It's all well and good to claim that this is something that the public likes, but I've seen no empirical evidence of that. There was no public debate. There were no public hearings in Tampa before this decision was made. So there's the question of community input, and there's also the question of what rules are in place to govern the use of these systems, and how are those rules developed? There are various ways in which these systems can be used. There can be real-time monitoring with no recording. There can be tapes created. If tapes are created, how long are they maintained? Who has access to them? Is facial recognition software implemented in the system? So there are a wide range of issues that need to be debated and addressed. And unfortunately, what seems to be happening is that people wake up one morning and find that there are now cameras on the streets.
When you hear Bob Black,
that's the basic problem.
When you hear Bob Black over in London telling us that the public there supports it overwhelmingly, what does that tell you, that the public can be educated into this? Or do you think?
Well, John, I think as you recognize, there are certainly some cultural differences. There are also differences in our legal system and expectations of privacy. And although I haven't seen any polling done on this issue in the United States yet, certainly privacy issues generally resonate very strongly with the American public. All types of privacy invasive technologies that have been the subjects of polling indicate that there is a growing public concern about the use of invasive technology, and people are basically getting to a point where they're feeling that every aspect of their lives are being monitored and recorded. And you know, now we might be on the verge of finding that even a walk down the street becomes the subject of monitoring and recording. And I think that is something that the average American has a very negative gut reaction to.
Dr. Adick, how do you do business in that climate?
Well, there's a flip side of the coin, which is the average America also demands the reduction in crime. People in the street have the right to go about their business feeling safe, and they have empowered their local law enforcement communities to adopt whatever technology and whatever means within which are legal, that do not affect the honest majority in any way, but affect the criminals, to help them reduce crime. And then we see it all over America. We see people are dealing with the real problem, which is crime, versus a theoretical problem, which is the possibility of abuse of a powerful technology. And I want to also comment a little bit about the fact that there has been a public hearing. In fact, before Tampa went ahead, the police in Tampa went ahead and installed the system, the city council argued and debated and voted unanimously to adopt the technology.
Dr. Adick, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Also, Bob Black, group leader of the Newham Emergency and Security Services in Newham, England. You're listening to The Connection. We're talking about all of the cameras in our lives. Is it good for us or is it bad for us? The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm John Donvan, and this is The Connection. We're looking at the issue of surveillance cameras in our lives, posited as a safety measure by those who support them, posited as a serious violation, intrusion into our privacy by those who oppose them. We're speaking with David Sobel of EPIC. We're also now joined by Simon Davies, who is the Director General of Privacy International, which is based in London and Washington. He is also a visiting fellow at the Department of Information Systems at the London School of Economics. And Amitai Etzioni, who is the author of The Limits of Privacy and University Professor of Sociology at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Simon Davies, in London, you are 10 years ahead of us in living with this technology and its ramifications, and you have very, very serious concerns.
Well, we've had concerns from the very beginning, only because it was very clear that once such a technology was introduced, it would creep into a great many aspects of our lives and our lifestyle. And what I think Britain represents at the moment is the, I suppose it's the development of a society where people expect to be watched. It's not just an expectation, it's now also a legal requirement in many circumstances. So what has become a fairly sort of, if you like, a bolt-on crime prevention measure has suddenly become a part of our urban design, part of our environment, part of the way we manage the population, to the extent now where we have in Britain, well, Privacy International's last estimates were 1.5 million CCTV cameras, video cameras, actually in the streets. So I see no end to this trend, particularly now that people are starting to expect that it is their right to be videotaped, and that's a fairly horrendous state of affairs for any democracy.
Is your concern what may be done with the information, the data gathered through surveillance, or is it a much more basic, fundamental human reaction that simply being watched is in itself a violation of your privacy?
I think it's a mix of responses that we have. Yes, we are concerned about the way the images will be used. We see video surveillance en masse as being a matter of power, you know, a change in the relationship of power between the citizen and the state. They are watching us. They are systematically watching us. They are monitoring our movements, sometimes automatically through computer software. So there is a question of power and a question of basic fundamental rights. But at another level, it's our belief that at a sort of psychosociological level, what happens is that people change. Their fundamental interrelationships change as a result of being watched. They become a little bit more unadventurous, more passive, more homogenous, slightly more neurotic.
Is this a suspicion or do you have evidence?
I think most of the psychological studies are indicating this. We haven't got any specific studies that actually target the basic change in society, the nature of society. But, for example, studies that are conducted on prisoners who are overtly watched in a sort of panopticon environment indicate that there is a basic change in the psychology of those people. Now, we can only extrapolate from that that there will be a change to society if they, too, are placed under surveillance.
Amitai Etzioni, Americans seem to have enshrined the notion of privacy as an absolute right. Number one, is there any such thing as an absolute right? You'll probably argue no. But number two, what about privacy? Does it deserve that sort of place on the pedestal?
I don't believe that anybody, even the most extreme advocate of the ACLU or the libertarians, argue that there are absolute rights of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
The First Amendment, which often is considered in the United States the most sacred of them all, the ACLU will tell you that there is no right to shout fire in a crowded theater. That's a cliche. So there are no absolute rights because, as already been said, we always recognize that we have more need than one. Sure, we want privacy. Who doesn't want privacy when it comes free? But we also want public safety. In effect, we have no rights unless there's a modicum of social order. So the American public is much less hysterical than some of your participants. They are willing to balance their need for safety and their need for privacy. Now, if we stop talking about privacy in the bathroom and all these cameras every place and look at what's happening here in the case you have before us, we're talking about public spaces, looking at the faces people present, not under their clothes, not in their briefcase. There is no right to privacy for your face in public space. By any court ruling, the reasonable expectation to privacy exists in your home, in your car, in things you sealed off. If I walk on Main Street naked, I have no expectation of privacy. Next, in this particular case, we have 300,000 criminals on the lam. These are convicted felons. They each commit more crimes because they have nothing to fear. If they get caught, they're going to jail. Anyhow, there is no right of a committed felon not to be caught. All the cameras do is what the police does, plainclothes people running around and surveyed. Nobody ever, even ACLU never argued that a policeman on the street has no right to see your face.
But
putting it all together, collapsing prisons and restrooms with the public streets, then we get a reasonable discussion here.
David Sobel, I think you were just referred to as hysterical by Dr. Tioni.
David is not. David is not.
All right.
Thank you, Amitai.
Simon occasionally strikes
Simon occasionally
note.
Is.
And I apologize. Hysterically, he's not. He's just a little more strident. It's absolutely not.
All right. So we're going to keep this civil. David Sobel, respond to that point. Dr. Etzioni is making the point that if you walk down the street naked, you have no expectation of privacy. But I think an awful lot of us walk down the street clothed with the expectation, nevertheless, that we're not being watched. That also seems to be the way people think things are working.
Well, that's certainly the status quo in the United States right now. And to say that there is some equivalence between walking past a police officer and walking past the camera, I think really misses the point. Just recently, within the last few weeks, the Supreme Court in the Kylo decision talked about the change that technology brings to this whole equation. That case involved the use of thermal imaging technology, and I think the point.
Can you just fill in our audience on what that decision?
Yeah, they better have it inside a home.
It involved the monitoring of a home, the outside of a home, with a thermal imaging device that allowed the police to determine that there was an unusual amount of heat emanating from that house, which then resulted in the issuance of a search warrant, which revealed that the occupant of the house was growing marijuana with grow lights, which was generating the heat. In throwing out that conviction, the Supreme Court, with Justice Scalia writing the opinion, noted that the use of enhancing technology, like thermal imaging, changes the equation to a certain extent. The point here was, yes, it was emanating from a house, but this was activity on the outside of the house by the police. So the point is that we have to look at all of these new technologies in a new light, legally and constitutionally. So I don't think we can say that a camera using facial recognition technology is the equivalent of a police officer. I don't think the police would make that argument, because obviously they think there's something they get from the use of these systems that they're not getting from patrolling the streets with police officers.
Yeah,
so
Well,
it's also a lot more efficient, and I think the efficiency raises some constitutional issues.
Well, we have
the fact that a database could conceivably be created that can be retrieved a year or two after someone has walked down the street is a fundamental change from the situation where a police officer observes something in real time.
We have a lot
John,
of...
Come on. Give the other side a chance.
Fair enough.
David is talking about something which emanated from inside the home. This is like the police going in the street and listening to what you say inside the home. Your home is your castle. That is where your privacy lives.
I think he made that point.
I understand.
Yes.
So therefore, to go from there to the cameras in the public street, I don't think is a reasonable transition. The Constitution does not recognize efficiency, as far as I know. It's not opposed to efficiency. So what we're talking about here is doing what a plainclothesman does. And if people believe that they have a right to go in a crime-infested area in public and not to be seen, then indeed it's high time we tell them it ain't so, it never was so, it shouldn't be so.
All right, gentlemen, the reason I keep trying to jump in is because we have a lot of callers on this subject. We've touched a nerve. I want to bring in John, who is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hello, John.
Hello?
Hello, John, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
First of all, I want to just touch on one or two issues. The first issue, on the thermal imaging. If the law enforcement were in my neighborhood and they found some guy making bombs down the street, I'd praise them for, you know, catching something like that. And if they catch somebody doing something illegal, I mean, what can they do about it? You mean, arrest them or say, oh, well, no, we didn't see this. And as far as the cameras, they just moved to Virginia Beach. When I started in the headlines, I was happy because I thought, hey, you know, this brings more security. And I was really surprised the next day to hear the big all the groups that came to move against it.
And John, you personally are fine with being watched?
Yeah, as long as I'm out, when I'm in the public, I want to be safe. And when I'm inside, I want to be private. So I have my privacy and my safety.
Would you want a truck going down the street monitoring your activities inside the house, you know, perhaps in a situation where they don't know exactly where they're looking, if the law were to allow that?
Well,
if the law were to allow that, which it won't at this point, would you feel comfortable with that if it were going to make everyone safer?
Well, yes, because I'm big on national security, and I think that they could find, you know, anything that was going on that wasn't supposed to be by doing that.
Now, we must have private spheres somewhere, otherwise we cannot have an independent country. But confounding the public and the private space is what exactly confuses this discussion. When we had rapes on our campus, women were very, very happy when we had cameras in public elevators, but they wouldn't dream of having them in their restrooms. And so the whole idea of privacy is to draw a distinction between private and public
and to strike a balance.
And collapsing the two is just not reasonable discussion.
Simon Davies, do you buy that distinction?
Well, I was about to comment there on this matter of balance that someone has just mentioned. Let's assume for a moment that there is a difference between a policeman observing you and a systematic surveillance, military-based surveillance system recording.
Where did military come in? Look at this. Listen to him. Where did military come in?
The technology originates from the military.
The technology came from the military, and a lot of the capabilities
came from the
military strength capabilities. No, just one moment. Give the other side a chance, as you say. The cameras have the capacity to automate vision capture, for instance, to see in the dark, to automatically capture images on the basis of who you are, what you look like, how you move. Now, if we assume that changes the nature of the surveillance, even slightly, then we're confronted with this situation. Do we say that the law enforcement advantages, crime control advantages, outweigh the privacy disadvantages? Now, to make that decision, we've got to say, does the technology cut crime? Now, I defy you to find one criminological study anywhere in the world that will indicate that CCTV reduces crime, because all of the major studies show the exact reverse.
And what if it did, Mr. Davies? What if the evidence were there that it did reduce crime? Would the sacrifice of privacy be worth making?
I doubt it. I think that it would enter into the equation, but I doubt that it would change certainly my point of view, because, I mean, you asked me at the beginning of this show, you know, what are my concerns? There are so many, and one that I should raise for the benefit of listeners, because I'm sure this is going to come up, is that one of the studies which was recently conducted by the University of Hull in Britain shows that something like 10 to 12% of all the images captured are captured for voyeuristic purposes, and a further 12% are captured for reasons of hatred or discrimination. Now you're getting to the heart of the human part of this system. Powerful technology being used for the wrong purposes. Again, you have to balance that out against any perceivable results.
Let me state it's a good example. First of all, in the system we just heard about, no images are captured at all. But here's the difference. When cops do that, and they are voyeuristic too, and surely in our country, they have shown all signs of racism, as we know, from racial profiling. We really have no close way of checking it. People come and testify, it's the person against the cop, word against word. If we would have these cameras, and somebody would come and charge that they used the way just being described by Mr. Davies, we could take a random sample and check it very easily. It's a much better control on the police than anything we have at the moment.
Let me bring in some callers. The number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joan is on the line. Joan?
Hi. I was mugged in Boston on my way home from work one evening about 25 years ago, and I saw the face of the person who attacked me. I found out afterwards there was actually a police car on the other end of the street at about the same time that this guy was whacking me in the head. The hospital notified the police. They wanted me to come in to look at mugshots. It took me hours to get out of the house the next day because I knew this guy had my address in my wallet, and he had seen that I saw his face. And I was sure he was waiting right outside the door to kill me.
And how would you connect your experience to the issue of having these cameras out there?
Well, I would feel I was not able to identify him. I didn't see him long enough to remember his face well enough to pull him out of the mugshots. I guess I would have felt safer for two reasons. For one thing, he might not have done it had he known that there was a camera there with somebody potentially watching. And even if he had, if his face was on camera, if he was in the system, the police would have been able to catch him, and I would have felt somewhat comfortable that he was off the street.
Joan, how much of a let me just ask Joan this question, Dr. Amazzoni. Would you be willing then to make the trade-off to have cameras on all streets where this might happen and all places where this might happen? Will you be comfortable with that?
Absolutely, because I was scared for years afterwards to be out at night at all and wound up taking taxis everywhere because I was afraid to walk home from the subway. I got a phone call about a month or so after I was attacked from somebody who said he had found my pocketbook, and I was sure it was this guy, and it took me months to go pick it up. So I think it would have given me much more of a sense of security.
Peace of mind. Joan, thank you for your call.
You're welcome.
Well, exactly what I'm going to do. I think we owe Joan and the previous caller a word of thanks, because they give some reality, some sense of what it's like to be out there in some of our streets. And the notion that most Americans object to improving safety by these relatively non-intrusive means in the public sphere is simply erroneous.
Well, Dr. Zioni, where do you think, we heard from Joan and the other caller, where do you think the public at large is on this? Are there more Jones out there, or are there more American Simon Davies out there?
The 85% of the Americans will say, according to surveys done by Alan Bestin, they love privacy. As long as you don't ask them that there's any benefit to be gained. Of course, we all like more privacy. I want more privacy for my mother-in-law. But the moment you say to them, but what if it helps reduce crime? What if it helps reduce rape? What if you feel safer going to your ATM machine if it's in the public street? They immediately, most of them realize how phony it is to talk about privacy without talking about the other half of the story.
Amitai,
I'd like you to hold that thought, and we'll return to it when we come back. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about surveillance cameras in our lives, a social good or social evil. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm John Donvan. You're listening to The Connection. David Sobel, General Counsel for the Electronic Privacy Information Center. I interrupted you as we took the break. Can you continue your point?
Sure. Amitai was suggesting that the American public's attitude is basically that anything goes when we're talking about technologies or techniques that increase security. And I would challenge that. I think the polling data for years has consistently showed, for instance, that the American public, by a two-thirds majority, is opposed to wiretapping. People feel very strongly about the use of invasive technologies by the government, by police departments. And even when asked if it might hamper police efforts to solve crimes, if wiretapping was restricted, the public says yes, they're willing to pay that price, if there is even that price. Certainly people make trade-offs. When we go into airports, most people don't mind that their baggage is being scanned or that we're going through metal detectors. But to say that that means people would consent to routine strip searches, for instance, I think is ridiculous. So, I just can't accept the idea that that the American public will accept any invasive technology so long as a case is made that it might cut crime a bit.
Let's listen to some more of the American public. The number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Gerard is on the line.
Good morning, John. Thanks for taking my call.
Good morning, Gerard.
I think what you're doing here is not only important but vital. It's not an ignored point. It's a taboo point. I disagree with the usage of a lot of UK input. No offense. Do respect the fact that they've gone through this. I disagree with your point that they're ahead 10 years. I think they're behind 10 years because they're allowing themselves to live with it.
Mm-hmm.
We have a founding father. I believe Ben Franklin said, "He who chooses safety over freedom deserves neither." Are any of you gentlemen familiar with that statement?
Yes, we are. And
that's only leading to my point.
Okay, go ahead. Make your point, please.
You host the show very well, Gerard.
Wait him to make the point. Go ahead.
I'm sort of in the security services. I'm a forensic accountant by trade. I see the uses of all sorts of electronic surveillance, whether it's email surveillance, keystroke surveillance, whatnot. I have a lot of friends in private security firms who admit to using cameras for what may be argued to be sexually harassing purposes. This has been a large basis of my opinion, in addition with professional and casual reading. I disagree, obviously, with huge popular surveillance. I would like to throw out to the panel what the police union feel on all this is. I don't believe that we should subjugate our freedoms to whether a thief, potential thief or rapist, is smart enough to know a camera's there, like the last caller asserted. If he knew it, he wouldn't have done that. Well, how's he going to know it's there?
Gerard, are you a member of the police union yourself?
I am not. I'm a 25-year-old private citizen.
Can I ask Gerard a question, please?
Absolutely.
Gerard, how do you think freedom was lost in Nazi Germany or in the Soviet Union? Was it lost because there were cameras or anything like it, or police in public?
Well, that's anachronistic, sir. I apologize for breaking you up, but that is anachronistic. I mean, they didn't have the cameras.
No, I realize that. I'm saying something like that. More police, more public order, too much public order.
Well, let me
ask you the question.
All right, gentlemen, I have to...
I'll be very short. I promise to be very short.
Please be brief.
Yes, the question is how we lose our democracy, how we lose freedom, because there is too much law and order or not enough. Historically, we lost our freedoms when there was no public order.
Dr. Etzioni, I was actually in Prague during the Velvet Revolution, and one of the great discoveries we journalists made, and we all did reports about it, was the fact that the Czech police had this sort of system in effect, and we all went to the headquarters and watched the entire community, and we all reported with it on horror, and it played back here with horror. Mm-hmm. It was used as a totalitarian tool.
Mm-hmm. The cameras didn't bring totalitarianism. Totalitarianism brought the cameras, right? Mm. So the question is, what drives what?
All right, I want to go to callers again. The number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, and Ben is calling from Manchester, New Hampshire.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. My concern is actually just what you were just speaking about, with the potential for government to really use this technology to manipulate the political process, to manipulate civil rights. For example, exactly what you were saying in Prague, with the police there being able to watch and track political opposition, and how that technology can be used in any country, really, to that same end.
Could I possibly answer that question?
Simon, sure, go ahead. Simon Davies in London.
In Great Britain, I'm not saying that this is a harbinger of things to come in the US, but in Great Britain, the police routinely use the images from cameras trained on protesters. So any aberrant activity, whether it's protest, any form of demonstration, any form of political activity, will be routinely filmed and used, scanned, and analyzed by the police under protection, under cloak of law. Because it is regarded as a potential public order issue.
David Sobel, is this your primary concern about the slippery slope we may be on?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a concern about how it is likely to be used on a day-to-day basis now, but certainly future abuse is a major concern. The point is that once this kind of invasive technology is built into our infrastructure, it becomes very hard, if not impossible, to control. So, for instance, when we look at initiatives like the FBI, in effect, redesigning our communications infrastructure, which is going on now, you have to ask the question, would we have been comfortable with J. Edgar Hoover having access to that kind of technology and those capabilities? So certainly, this is not just a question for today. It's a question of looking ahead and anticipating how these kinds of changes to the infrastructure might be abused in the future.
Ben, you're calling from the state with a live free or die on the license plate. Do you think that this sort of potential government intrusion will ever fly in your state?
Well, I don't necessarily think it's a distinct reality, but it definitely has that potential to be manipulated, and that is a real concern. I don't think any state or any governmental body anticipates
one of their leaders coming to manipulate public policy in this way, but it has happened so many times in the past that it is a real possibility.
I'm in favor of abolishing trains immediately, because Nazis used trains. That's the same logic. Anything which helps us now to support public safety, we should not use, because one day a tyrant may come. If there is a danger of tyranny, we have to fight it much more, but then closing now things which help us to protect public safety.
All right, Ben, thank you for calling. John is on the line. John?
Hello.
Hi, John. We hear you.
I'm calling from Lowell, Massachusetts, and I'd like to answer Dr. Etzioni's question of what drives what.
Do the cameras drive totalitarianism, right, or do the totalitarianism drive the cameras?
Right. I think that's a great question, and I think the man in the street thinks about that. And it's part of human nature that whatever you have the tool to do, you're likely to try to do it, number one. So any new technology really expands people's capacities to do things. So it is quite possible that a surveillance technology will tempt people to expand their power. That's answer number one. So sometimes technology does drive bad behavior. But a second point I want to make to you is this. The real question about tyranny is who is surveilling who? And it's not necessarily a bad idea to, certainly it's a good idea to maintain public order. But those of our public citizens, those of our citizens who are in the police department, if they have control over those images and the rest of us don't, there's an imbalance of surveillance. When they get to surveil our behavior and we don't get to watch their behavior, that's when you're really inviting in trouble. And the American system basically says the average citizen is going to have lots of ability to watch its government. And if we were to put cameras on street corners, it would be a very different effect, for instance, if every citizen in a city could go look at the database. That would even up the power differential between the watchers and the watched. But short of that, I think there's a real strong danger of misuse.
Simon Davies.
Lovely idea, and by the way, is what we're doing. We're putting our cameras in police cars, which record when they chase somebody, not only the person they're chasing, but their conduct, and improved as a result. But I just want to call attention that over these years in the United States, where some of these technologies were introduced in the public spaces, nothing to do with tapping people's homes. We had a major reduction in crime. There are many reasons for that, but one of them is that we, for instance, abolished skyjacking once we introduced the screening gates. So we need to keep some sense of balance here as long as we talk about public spaces.
Do we have the right to look at these databases in any of these systems? What about in the United Kingdom, Simon Davies?
There is. You can, under United Kingdom law, scrutinize databases so long as there's data relating to you as an individual. We still have an endemic problem in the European bureaucracy of closed government, secret government. But if I could respond to Amitai's point and to the point of your last caller, I don't buy this argument that surveillance of the population is justified by an increase in the population's surveillance of government, because I do not believe that fundamentally government wants to reveal itself to the public. I think you'll always find a reluctance, an institutionalized reluctance by government, and institutionalized protection for government in law. So it's always going to be imbalanced, always out of balance.
So, Simon, should we abolish new technologies?
I think there are some technologies we should consider. I think some genetic technologies, as we've banned some nuclear technologies and some biochemical technologies. Definitely there are some technologies which should be off the books. Mm-hmm.
The number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Jim, Norfolk, Virginia.
Hi.
Hi, Jim.
Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to say I agree wholeheartedly with the last two callers, and I would like to also kind of respond to what the gentleman was just saying. Maybe in the UK, there's not that much responsibility for the government to reveal itself to the people, but it's different here. We have a expectation of, or a presumption of innocence in our country. And where does this technology lead us with regard to that? I also live not far from Virginia Beach, where it was just announced that they're going to have that technology there. And the mayor there just decided that we really need to hear from the people first that they're not going to go forward with FACES technology until then. Also, I have one additional little question. Does anybody know whether China uses this technology?
China imported from the United Kingdom the Scoot camera system, which was actually used for traffic control in Tiananmen Square. When the Tiananmen Square pro-demonstration rallies occurred, those images, of course, were used by the authorities, broadcast across Chinese television to capture the dissidents. I'm not saying that's a reason to ban the technology. I'm just saying that it's certainly being used by third world governments for that purpose.
Jim, thank you for your call. David Sobel, you're working this whole issue in Washington, lobbying in Congress for some sort of systematic approach to it. What we're hearing is, in the last call and other calls, is that it's taking place, it's happening, the cameras are moving,
right,
and communities are making the decision one by one that this is just fine, this is going to work, and they need it.
I'm not sure that's what we're
well,
hearing.
That's my question. What's your sense in Congress? Are you beginning to see strong resistance, and where do you think this is going to be going?
Well, we need to keep in mind that to a large extent this is being implemented at the local level. It is not necessarily a federal matter. And I'm happy to hear, for instance, that the mayor of Virginia Beach has now decided to slow down on this initiative and to bring the public in, because I think that's been what's lacking. The first point that I made this morning is that we really need to have a public debate on this issue. So it's not so much an issue that really needs to be decided in Washington, I think. Public discussion needs to take place locally, and each community needs to make its decision.
All right, David, thank you very much, and many thanks to all of our guests in London, Simon Davies, Director General of Privacy International and a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics. In Washington, D.C., Amitai Etzioni, author of The Limits of Privacy and professor of sociology at George Washington University. David Sobel, General Counsel to EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center. We were joined earlier by Bob Black, Group Leader of Emergency and Security Services in the London Borough of Newham, England, and Dr. Joseph Attic, President and CEO of Visionix, which makes the face recognition software used in Newham and Tampa. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation online at theconnection.org. I'm John Donvan. This is The Connection.